Geryon spent most days closeted with Kale now. Many decisions had been made in his absence, although almost without exception he approved of Kale's handling of those matters. He still needed to be briefed on them, and some of those decisions needed to be ratified by the royal signature. Saedhra's pregnancy was proceeding along expected lines. The little queen bloomed and swelled and became increasingly short-tempered. The peculiar hungers for exotic foods that sometimes beset ladies in that delicate condition were not nearly as much fun for the Riven Queen as they were for most other ladies. There has long been a suspicion in the male half of the population that these gastronomical yearnings are nothing more than a peculiar form of entertainment for their wives. The more exotic and unobtainable a given food might be, and the more extreme the lengths to which a doting husband must go to put his hands on it, the more the ladies would insist that they would absolutely die if it were not provided in abundance. Geryon privately suspected that the whole business involved little more than a desire for reassurance. If a husband proved willing to disassemble the known world to obtain strawberries out of season or strange seafoods normally found only in waters half a world away, it was a sure sign that he still loved his wife, despite her disappearing waistline. It was not nearly as much fun for Saedhra, because each time she made a seemingly impossible request, Geryon simply stepped into the next room, created the foodstuff in question on the spot, and presented it to her, usually on a silver platter. Saedhra grew increasingly sulky about the whole business, and finally gave up on it entirely. And then, late on a very frosty autumn evening, an ice-coated Malorian ship entered the harbor, and her captain delivered a packet of neatly folded parchment bearing the seal of Zakath of Meloria. Geryon thanked the seaman profusely, offered him and his crew the hospitality of the citadel, and then immediately carried Zakath's letter to the royal apartment. Saedhra was sitting by the fire, knitting. Geryon and the young wolf were lying together on the hearth, both of them dozing and twitching slightly as they dreamed. The two always slept together. Saedhra had finally given up the idea of trying to keep them separate at night, since no door in the world could be effectively locked from both sides.
"What is it, dear?"
she asked as Geryon entered. "We just received a letter from Zakath."
"Oh? What does he say?"
"I haven't read it yet."
"Open it, Geryon. I'm dying to find out what's happening in Malzeth."
Geryon broke the seal and unfolded the parchment. "For His Majesty King Belgarion of Riva," he read aloud, "Overlord of the West, Godslayer, Lord of the Western Sea, and for His Revered Queen Saedhra, co-ruler of the Isle of the Winds, Princess of the Tolnedrin Empire and Jewel of the House of Borun, from Zakath, Emperor of all of Angarak."
"I hope this finds you both in good health, and I send greetings to your daughter, whether she has already arrived or if her birth be still impending. I have not, I hasten to assure you, become suddenly clairvoyant. Saradis said once that she was no longer blessed with her vision. I have come to suspect that she was not entirely truthful on that score. A great deal has happened here since we parted. The Imperial Court, I suspect, was more than a little pleased by the alteration in my personality, which was the direct result of our journey to Khorim, and by what happened there. I must have been an impossible ruler to deal with. This is not to suggest that all here in Malzeth has become a fairy tale of good feeling and felicity. The General Staff was mightily upset when I declared my intention to conclude a peace treaty with King Urgot. You know how generals are. If you take their favorite war away from them, they snivel and complain and pout like spoiled children. I had to step on a few necks quite firmly. Incidentally, I recently promoted Ateska to the position of Commander-in-Chief of the Armies of Meloria. This also enraged the other members of the General Staff, but no one can please everybody. Urgot and I have been in communication with each other, and I find him to be a rare fellow, quite nearly as droll as his brother. I think we will get on well together. The bureaucracy very nearly went into collective apoplexy when I announced the autonomy of the Dalassian protectorates. It is my feeling that the Dals must be permitted to go their own way, but many members of the bureaucracy have vested interests there, and they sniveled and complained and pouted almost as much as the generals did. That came to an abrupt halt, however, when I announced my intention to have Braedor conduct a thorough audit of the affairs of every bureau chief in the government. The sound of a massive divestiture of all holdings in the protectorates was well nigh deafening. Rather surprisingly, an ancient Grolem arrived at the palace shortly after we returned from Dal Perivor. I was about to send him away, but Eriand insisted rather firmly that he remain. The old fellow had some unpronounceable Grolem name, but Eriand changed it to Pelath for some reason. The old boy has a sweet disposition, but he sometimes speaks very strangely. The language he uses sounds very much like that of the Ashabin oracles, or the Malorian Gospels of the Dals. Very peculiar.
I had almost forgotten that, Garion interrupted his reading.
What's that, dear?
Tenedra asked him, looking up from her knitting. Do you remember that old Grolem we met in Peldane? That night when the chicken bit you?
Yes. He seemed like a very nice old man.
He was more than that, Tenedra. He was also a prophet, and the voice told me that he was going to become Erion's first disciple.
Erion has a very long arm, hasn't he? Keep reading, Garion.
Ceradus, Pelath, and I have conferred extensively with Erion, and we've all agreed that his status should remain concealed, for the time being at least. He is such an innocent that I don't want to expose him to the depths of human depravity and chicanery just yet. Let's not discourage him so early in his career. We all remembered Torak and his overpowering hunger for worship, but when we offered to worship Eriand, he just laughed at us. Did Polgara perhaps leave something out when she was raising him? We did make one exception, however. A group of us, accompanied by the 3rd, 7th, and 9th armies, visited Malyaska. The temple guardmen and Kandam attempted to flee, but Ateska rather effectively rounded them up. I waited until Eriand was off for his morning ride on that unnamed horse of his, and spoke quite firmly with the assembled Grolems. I did not want to cause Eriand any distress, but I indicated to the Grolems that I would be most unhappy if they did not change their religious affiliation forthwith. Ateska stood at my side playing with his sword, so they immediately got my drift. Then, with no warning at all, Eriand appeared in the temple. How does that horse of his move so fast? The last time he had been observed that morning, he had been more than 3 leagues from the city. He told them that black robes were not really all that attractive, and that white ones would become them much more. Then, with no more than a faint smile, he actually changed the color of every Grolem robe in the temple. So much for his anonymity in that part of Meloria, I'm afraid. Next, he told them that they'd no longer need their knives, and every dagger in the place disappeared. Then he extinguished the fires in the sanctum and decorated the altar with flowers.
I have since been advised that these trifling modifications are universal here in Meloria. Urgot is presently investigating to determine if similar conditions prevail in Tol Mirgos. Our new god, I think, will take a bit of getting used to. To make it short, the Grolems all fell down on their faces. I still suspect that at least some of those conversions may have been fraudulent, so I am not contemplating a demobilization of the army just yet. Arion told them to get back on their feet and go out and care for the sick, the poor, the orphaned, and the homeless. On our way back to Malzeth, Peleth pulled his horse in beside mine, smiled that sickeningly sweet smile of his at me, and said, "My master believes that it's time for you to change your status, Emperor of Meloria." That gave me a bit of a turn. I was about half afraid that Eriond might suggest that I abdicate and take up sheep-herding or something. Then Peleth went on, "My master believes that you have delayed something for quite long enough." "Oh?" I said cautiously. "The delay is causing the Seeress of Calais certain distress. My master strongly suggests that you ask her to marry you. He wants that settled before anything comes along to interfere." So, when we got to Malzeth, I made what I thought was a very sensible proposal. Enceradus turned me down flat. I thought my heart would stop. Then our mystic little seeress waxed eloquent. She told me at great length what she thought of sensible. I've never seen her behave that way before. She was actually passionate, and some of the words she used, though archaic, were hardly flattering. I had to look some of them up, they were so obscure.
"Good for her," Cenedra said fiercely.
"Just to make peace," the letter went on, "I fell to my knees and made a fatuous and embarrassingly gushy proposal, and she was moved by my eloquence to relent and accept me."
"Men,"
Cenedra snorted. "The cost of the wedding very nearly bankrupted me. I even had to borrow money from one of Geldar's business associates, at an outrageous rate of interest. Arion officiated, of course, and having a god perform the ceremony really nailed down the lid on my coffin. At any rate, Siredis and I were married last month, and I can truly say that I have never been happier in my life."
"Oh,"
Cenedra said, with that familiar catch in her voice.
"That's just lovely."
She went to the handkerchief.
"There's more," Geryon told her.
"Keep going,"
she said, dabbing at her eyes.
"The Angorak Melorians were not really pleased that I had chosen to marry a Dal. But they are wisely keeping their displeasure to themselves.
I've changed a great deal, but not that much. Zaratus is having some difficulty adapting to her new status, and I simply cannot convince her that jewels are a necessary adornment for an empress. She wears flowers instead, and the slavish imitation of the ladies of the court has caused universal despair in the hearts of the jewelers here in Malzeth. I was going to have my distant cousin, the Archduke Othrath, shortened by the length of his head. But he's such a pathetic fool that I discarded the idea and sent him home instead. Following a suggestion your friend Belden made in Dal Perivor, I ordered the cretin to set his wife up in a palace in the city of Malcine, and never to go near her again for the rest of his life. I understand that the lady is something of a scandal in Malcine, but she probably deserves some recompense for putting up with that silly ass for all of those years. That's about all from here, Geryon. We are really hungry for news of all our friends, and we send them our warmest greetings and affection. Sincerely, Zakath and Empress Ceradus. Note that I am deleting that ostentatious prefix. Oh, by the way, my cat was unfaithful to me again a few months ago. Would Tenedra like a kitten? Or maybe one for your new daughter? I can send two, if you would like. Signed, Z.
In the early winter of that year, the Raven Queen grew increasingly discontent. A discontentment and a waspish temper almost in direct proportion to her increasing girth. Some ladies might be uniquely suited for pregnancy. The Raven Queen was uniquely not. She was snippy with her husband. She was short with her son. And on one occasion, she even made an awkward attempt to kick the unoffending young wolf. The wolf nimbly dodged the kick, then looked with some puzzlement at Geryon.
"Has one somehow given offense?"
he asked. "No," Geryon told him. "It is only that one's mate is in some distress. The time of her whelping is approaching, and this always makes the she's of the man-things uncomfortable and short-tempered."
"Ah,"
the wolf said,
"the man-things are very strange."
"Truly," Geryon agreed. It was Greldic, naturally, who delivered Poledra to the Isle of the Winds in the middle of a howling blizzard.
"How did you find your way?" Geryon asked the fur-clad seaman, as the two of them sat before the fire in the low-beamed dining hall with tankards of ale in their hands.
"Velgrace, wife. Pointed the way," Greldic shrugged. "That's a remarkable woman, do you know that?"
"Oh, yes."
"Do you know that not one man in my whole crew took a single drink while we were at sea? Not even me. For some reason, we just didn't want any."
"My grandmother has strong prejudices. Will you be all right here? I want to go up and have a chat with her."
"That's all right, Geryon," Greldic grinned, patting the nearly full ale keg affectionately. "I'll be just fine."
Geryon went upstairs to the royal apartments. The tawny-haired woman sat by the fire, idly stroking the young wolf's ears. Tenedra was sprawled rather awkwardly on a divan.
"Ah, there you are, Geryon,"
Poledra said. She sniffed the air rather delicately.
"I notice you've been drinking."
Her tone was disapproving.
"I had one tankard with Greldic."
"Would you please sit over there on the other side of the room, then? One's sense of smell is quite acute, and the odor of ale turns one's stomach."
"Is that why you disapprove of drinking?"
"Of course. What other reason could there be?"
"I think Aunt Paul disapproves on some sort of moral grounds."
"Polgara has some obscure prejudices now and then,"
she went on seriously.
"My daughter is in no condition to travel just now, so I am here to deliver Tenedra's baby. Paul gave me all sorts of instructions, most of which I intend to ignore. Giving birth is a natural process, and the less interference, the better. When it starts, I want you to take Geryon and this young wolf here and go to the extreme far end of the citadel. I'll send for you when it's all over." "Yes, grandmother." "He's a nice boy,"
Poledra said to the Raven Queen.
"I rather like him." "I certainly hope so. All right then, Geryon, just as soon as the baby's born, and we are sure everything's all right, you and I are going to return to the Vale. Polgara is a few weeks behind Tenedra, but we really don't have too much time to waste. Paul wants you to be there when she gives birth."
"You have to go, Geryon,"
Tenedra said.
"I only wish I could."
Geryon was a bit dubious about leaving his wife so soon after she was delivered, but he definitely did want to be in the Vale when Aunt Paul had her baby. It was 3 nights later. Geryon was having a splendid dream that involved riding down a long grassy hill with Eriond.
Geryon,
Tenedra said, nudging him in the ribs.
Yes, dear.
He was still about half asleep.
I think you'd better go get your grandmother.
He was fully awake immediately.
Are you sure?
We've been through this before, dear,
she told him. He rolled quickly out of bed.
Kiss me before you go,
she told him. He did that.
And don't forget to take Geryon and the puppy when you go off to the other end of the building. Put Geryon back to bed when you get there.
Of course.
A strange expression came over her face.
I think you'd better hurry, Geryon,
she suggested. Geryon bolted. It was nearly dawn when the Queen of Riva was delivered of a baby girl. The infant had a short crop of deep red hair and green eyes. As it had for so many centuries, the dryad strain bred true. Poledra carried the blanket-wrapped baby through the silent halls of the citadel to the rooms where Geryon sat before a fire, and Geryon and the wolf slept in a tangle of arms, legs, and paws on a divan.
Is Senedra all right?
Geryon asked, coming to his feet.
She is fine, his grandmother assured him. A little tired is all. It was a fairly easy delivery.
Geryon heaved a sigh of relief, then turned back the corner of the blanket to look at the small face of his daughter.
She looks like her mother, he said.
People the world over always make that first observation, pointing out the similarities of a newborn to this parent or that, as if such resemblances were somehow remarkable. Geryon gently took the baby in his arms and looked into that tiny red face. The baby looked back at him, her green-eyed gaze unwavering. It was a familiar gaze.
Good morning, Beldaran,
Geryon said softly. He had made that decision quite some time ago. There would be other daughters, and they would be named after a fair number of female relatives on both sides of the family, but it somehow seemed important that his first daughter should be named for Aunt Paul's blonde twin sister, a woman who, though Geryon had seen only her image and then only once, was still somehow central to all their lives.
Thank you, Geryon,
Poledra said simply.
It seems appropriate somehow, Geryon told her.
Prince Geryon was not too impressed with his baby sister, but boys seldom are.
Isn't she awfully little?
He asked, when his father woke him to introduce them.
It's the nature of babies to be little. She'll grow.
Good.
Geryon looked at her gravely. Then, apparently feeling that he should say something nice about her, he added,
She has nice hair. It's the same color as mother's, isn't it?
I noticed that myself.
The bells of Riva pealed out that morning in celebration, and the Riven people rejoiced, although there were some, many, perhaps, who secretly wished that the royal infant might have been another boy, just for the sake of dynastic security. The Rivens, kingless for so many centuries, were nervous about that sort of thing. Tenedra, of course, was radiant. She expressed only minimal dissatisfaction with Geryon's choice of a name for their daughter. Her dryad heritage felt rather strongly the need for a name beginning with the traditional X. She worked with it a bit, however, and came up with a satisfactory solution to the problem. Geryon was fairly certain that in her own mind she had inserted an X somewhere in Beldaran's name. He decided that he didn't really want to know about it. The Riven Queen was young and healthy, and she recovered from her confinement quickly. She remained in bed for a few days, largely for the dramatic effect on the stream of Riven nobility and foreign dignitaries who filed through the royal bedchamber to view the tiny queen and the even tinier princess. After a few days, Poledra spoke with Geryon.
That more or less takes care of business here. And we really should get started back to the Vale. Palgora's time is coming closer, you know.
Geryon nodded. I asked Greldic to stay. He will get us back to Sundaria faster than anybody else can. He is a very undependable man, you know. Aunt Paul said exactly the same thing. He is still the finest sailor in the world. I'll make arrangements to have horses put on board his ship. No, she said shortly. We are in a hurry, Geryon. Horses would only slow us down. You want to run all the way from the coast of Sundaria to the Vale? He asked her, a little startled.
It's not really all that far, Geryon, she smiled.
What about supplies? She gave him an amused look, and he suddenly felt very foolish. Geryon's goodbyes to his family were emotional, though brief.
Be sure to dress warmly, Tenedra instructed. It is winter, you know.
He decided not to tell her exactly how he and his grandmother intended to travel.
Oh,
she said, handing him a parchment sheet.
Give this to Aunt Paul.
Geryon looked at the sheet. It was a rather fair artist's sketch in color of his wife and daughter.
It's quite good, isn't it?
Tenedra said.
Very good, he agreed.
You had better run along now,
she said.
If you stay much longer, I won't let you go at all.
Keep warm, Sinedra, and look after the children.
Naturally. I love you, Your Majesty.
I love you too, Your Majesty.
He kissed her and his son and daughter, and quietly left the room. The weather at sea was blustery, but the militantly impetuous Greldic paid almost no attention to weather, no matter how foul. His patched and decidedly scruffy-looking ship ran before the wind across a stormy sea, under far more sail than even a marginally prudent sea captain would have crowded onto his masts. And 2 days later, they reached the coast of Sundaria.
An empty beach will do, Greldic, Geryon told him. We are in sort of a hurry, and if we stop at Sindar, Tholrak and Layla will tie us up with congratulations and banquets.
How do you propose to get off a beach without horses?
Greldic asked bluntly.
There are ways, Geryon told him.
More of that sort of thing,
Greldic said with a certain distaste. Geryon nodded.
That's unnatural, you know.
I come from an unnatural sort of family.
Greldic grunted disapprovingly and ran his ship in close to a windswept beach bordered on its upper edge with the rank grass of a salt flat.
Does this one suit you? He asked.
It's just fine, Geryon said.
Geryon and his grandmother waited on the windy beach with their cloaks whipping around them until Greldic was well out to sea.
I suppose we can get started now, Geryon said, shifting his sword into a more comfortable position. I don't know why you brought that, Poledra said. The orb wants to see Aunt Paul's baby, he shrugged. That may just be the most irrational thing I have ever heard anyone say, Geryon. Shall we go?
They shimmered and blurred, and then two wolves loped up the beach to the bordering grass and ran smoothly inland. It took the two of them a little more than a week to reach the Vale. They stopped only rarely to hunt and even more infrequently to rest. Geryon learned a great deal about being a wolf during that week. Belgarath had given him a certain amount of instruction in the past, but Belgarath had come into wolfhood when he had been full grown. Poledra, on the other hand, was the genuine article. They crested the hill overlooking the cottage one snowy evening and looked down at the tidy farmstead with its fence lines half buried in snow and the windows of the cottage glowing a warm, welcoming yellow.
Are we in time?
Geryon asked the golden-eyed wolf beside him.
Yes, Poledra replied. One suspects, however, that the decision not to burden ourselves with the beasts of the man-things was wise. The time is very close. Let us go down and find out what is happening.
They loped on down the hill through swirling snowflakes and changed back into their own forms in the dooryard. The interior of the cottage was warm and bright. Polgara, more than a little ungainly, was setting places for Geryon and her mother at the table. Belgarath sat near the fire, and Durnik was patiently mending harness.
"I saved some supper for you," Aunt Paul told Geryon and Poledra. "We have already eaten."
"You knew we'd get here this evening?" Geryon asked.
"Of course, dear. Mother and I always stay more or less in constant contact. How is Sinedra?"
"She and Beldoran are just fine."
He said it in an offhand sort of way. Aunt Paul had surprised him often enough in the past. Now, it was his turn. She almost dropped a plate, and her glorious eyes grew wide.
"Oh, Geryon,"
she said, embracing him suddenly.
"Does the name please you? Just a little?"
"More than you could ever know, Geryon."
"How are you feeling, Polgara?"
Poledra asked, removing her cloak.
"Fine, I think," Aunt Paul smiled. "I know about the procedure, of course, but this is the first time I have experienced it personally. Babies spend a great deal of time kicking at this stage, don't they? A few minutes or so ago, I think mine kicked me in three separate places at once."
"Maybe he's punching, too," Durnik suggested.
"He?"
she smiled.
"Well, the lad's just for the sake of convenience, Paul. If you'd like, I could have a look and tell you if it's a he or a she," Belgarath offered.
"Don't you dare," Polgara told him. "I want to find out for myself."
The snow let up shortly before daybreak, and the clouds blew off by mid-morning. The sun came out, and it glittered brightly on the new fallen blanket of white around the cottage. The sky was intensely blue, and though it was cold that day, the bitter chill of midwinter had not yet set in. Geryon, Durnik, and Belgarath had been banished from the house at dawn, and they wandered about with that odd sort of uselessness men usually feel in such circumstances. At one point, they stopped on the bank of the small stream that threaded its way through the farmstead. Belgarath looked down into the clear water, noting a number of dark, slim shapes just below the surface.
"Have you had time to do any fishing?" he asked Durnik.
"No," Durnik said a bit sadly. "And I don't seem to have the enthusiasm for it I used to."
They all knew why, but none of them mentioned it. Poledra brought their meals to them, but firmly insisted that they remain outside. Late in the afternoon, she put them to work boiling water over Durnik's forge, which sat in the tool shed.
"I've never seen any reason for this,"
Durnik confessed, lifting another steaming kettle from his forge.
"Why do they always need boiling water?"
"They don't," Belgarath told him.
Belgarath was comfortably sprawled on a woodpile and was examining the intricately carved cradle Durnik had built.
"It's just a way to keep the menfolk out from underfoot. Some female genius came up with the idea thousands of years ago, and women have been honoring the custom ever since. Just boil water, Durnik. It makes the women happy, and it's not that big of a chore."
The moon had been rising late, but the stars touched the snow with a fairy light, and all the world seemed somehow bathed in a gentle blue-white glow. It was, of all nights, among the closest to perfect Geryon had ever seen, and all of nature seemed to be holding its breath. Geryon and Belgarath, noting Durnik's increasing edginess, suggested that they walk to the top of the hill to settle their suppers. They had both observed in the past that Durnik usually banished uncomfortable emotions by keeping busy. The smith looked up at the night sky as they trudged through the snow toward the top of the hill.
"It is really a special sort of night, isn't it?"
He laughed a little sheepishly.
I suppose I'd feel that way even if it were raining.
I know I always do, Geryon said. Then he too laughed, his breath steaming in the chill night air. I don't know that twice qualifies as much of an always, though, he conceded. But I know what you mean. I was feeling sort of the same way myself earlier.
He looked beyond the cottage across the snowy plain lying white and still beneath the icy stars.
Does it seem very, very quiet to you two as well?
There's not a hint of a breeze, Durnick agreed. And the snow muffles all the sound.
He cocked his head.
Now that you mention it, though, it does seem awfully quiet, and the stars are really bright tonight. Well, there's a logical explanation for it, I suppose.
Belgarath smiled at them.
There's not a single ounce of romance in either one of you, is there? Didn't it ever occur to you that this might just be a very special night?
They looked at him oddly.
Stop and think about it. Paul has devoted most of her life to raising children that were not hers. I have watched her do it. And I could feel an obscure kind of pain in her each time she took a new baby in her arms. That is going to change tonight. So in a very real sense, this is a special night. Tonight, Polgar is going to get a baby of her very own. It may not mean all that much to the rest of the world, but I think it does to us.
It does indeed, Durnick said fervently.
Then a thoughtful expression came into the good man's eyes.
I've been sort of working on something lately, Belgarath.
Yes, I've heard you.
Doesn't it seem to you that we are all sort of coming back to the places where we started? It's not exactly the same, of course, but things sort of feel familiar.
I've been thinking sort of the same thing, Geryon admitted. I keep getting this strange feeling about it.
It is only natural for people to go home after they have been on a long journey, isn't it?
Belgarath said, kicking at a lump of snow with one foot.
I don't think it's that simple, Grandfather.
Neither do I, Durnick agreed. This seems more important for some reason.
Belgarath frowned.
I think it does to me as well, he admitted. I wish Belden were here.
He could explain it in a minute. Of course, none of us would understand the explanation, but he would explain it all the same.
He scratched at his beard.
I have found something that might explain it, he said a bit dubiously.
What's that? Durnick asked him.
Geryon and I have had an extended conversation over the last year or so. He would notice that things kept happening over and over again. You probably heard us talking about it.
Durnick nodded.
Between us, we came up with the notion that things kept repeating themselves, because the accident made it impossible for the future to happen.
Well, that makes sense, I guess.
Anyhow, that has changed now. Serratus made her choice, and the effects of the accident have been erased. The future can happen now.
Then why is everybody going back to the place where he started? Geryon asked.
It's only logical, Geryon.
Durnick told him quite seriously.
When you're starting something, even the future, you almost have to go back to the beginning, don't you?
Why don't we just assume that's the explanation? Belgarath said. Things got stopped. Now they are moving again. And everybody got what he deserved. We got the good things, and the other side got the bad ones. It sort of proves that we picked the right side, doesn't it?
Geryon suddenly laughed.
What's so funny? Durnick asked him.
Just before our baby was born, Tenedra got a letter from Velvet, Lizelle. She's managed to push Silk into naming a day. It's probably what he deserves, all right, but I imagine his eyes get a little wild every time he thinks about it.
"When's the wedding?" Durnick asked. "Next summer sometime. Lassell wants to be sure that everybody can be in Boktor to witness her triumph over our friend."
"That's a spiteful thing to say, Geryon," Durnick reproved. "It's probably the truth, though," Belgarath grinned. He reached inside his tunic and drew out an earthenware flagon. "A touch of something to ward off the chill," he offered. "It's some of that potent Ulgo brew."
"Grandmother won't like that," Geryon warned.
"Your grandmother isn't here right now, Geryon. She's a little busy at the moment."
The three of them stood atop the snowy hill, looking down at the farmstead. The thatched roof was thick with snow, and icicles hung like glittering jewels from the eaves. The small panes of the windows glowed with golden lamplight that fell softly out over the gently mounded snow in the dooryard, and the ruddy glow from the forge where the menfolk had spent the afternoon, boiling unneeded water, came softly from the shed. A column of blue wood smoke rose straight and unwavering from the chimney, reaching so high that it seemed almost to be lost among the stars. A peculiar sound filled Geryon's ears, and it took them a while to identify it. It was the orb, and it was singing a song of unutterable longing. The silence seemed almost palpable now, and the glittering stars seemed to draw even closer to the snowy earth. And then, from the cottage there came a single cry. It was an infant voice, and it was not filled with that indignation and discomfort so common in the cries of most newborns, but rather with a kind of wonder and ineffable joy. A gentle blue light suddenly came from the orb, and the longing in its note turned to joy. As the song of the orb faded, Durnick drew in a deep breath.
"Why didn't we go down?" he said.
"We had better wait a bit," Belgarath suggested. "There is always some cleaning up to do at this point, and we should give Paul a chance to brush her hair."
"I don't care if her hair's a little mussed," Durnick said.
"She does. Let's wait."
Strangely, the orb had renewed its yearning melody. The silence remained as palpable as before, broken now only by the thin, joyous wail of Bulgara's baby. The three friends stood on the hilltop, their breath steaming in the cold night air as they listened to that distant piping song.
"Good healthy lungs,"
Geryon complimented the new father. Durnick grinned briefly at him, still listening to the cry of his child. And then, that single cry was not alone. Another voice joined in. This time, the light that burst from the orb was a sudden blaze of blue that illuminated the snow around them, and its joyous song was a triumphant organ note.
"I knew it!" Belgarath exclaimed with delight.
"Two?" Durnick gasped.
"Twins?"
"It's a family trait, Durnick," Belgarath laughed, catching the smith in a rough embrace.
"Are they boys or girls?" Durnick demanded. "What difference does it make right now? But we might as well go on down there and find out, I suppose."
But as they turned, they saw that something seemed to be happening in the vicinity of the cottage. They stared at the single shaft of intensely blue light descending from the starry sky, a shaft that was soon joined by one of paler blue. The cottage was bathed in their azure light as the two lights from the heavens touched the snow. Then those lights were joined by other lights, red and yellow and green and lavender, and a shade Geryon could not even put a name to. Last, the lights from the sky were joined by a single shaft of blinding white. Like the colors of the rainbow, the lights stood in a semicircle in the dooryard, and the brilliant columns from which they had descended rose above them to fill the night sky with a pulsing curtain of many-hued shifting light. And then, the gods were there, standing in the dooryard with their song joining with that of the orb in a mighty benediction. Eriond turned to look up the hill at them,
His gentle face glowed with a smile of purest joy. He beckoned to them.
"Join us," he said.
"Now it is complete."
Ol's voice was also joyous.
"All is well now."
Then, with the godlight bathing their faces, the three friends started down from the snowy hilltop to view that miracle, which, though it is most commonplace, is a miracle, nonetheless. And so, my children, the time has come to close the book. There will be other days and other stories, but this tale is finished.
You've been listening to The Seeress of Kell, Book 5 of The Malorian by David Eddings. Eddings was born in Spokane, Washington in 1931 and was raised in the Puget Sound area north of Seattle. He received a Bachelor of Arts degree from Reed College in Portland, Oregon in 1954 and a Master of Arts degree from the University of Washington in 1961. He has served in the United States Army, worked as a buyer for the Boeing Company, has been a grocery clerk, and has taught English. He has lived in many parts of the United States. His first novel, High Hunt, published by Putnam in 1973, was a contemporary adventure story. The field of fantasy has always been of interest to him, however, and he turned to the Belgariad in an effort to develop certain technical and philosophical ideas concerning that genre. Of course, this book and the entire series are works of fiction. All names, characters, places, and events are works of the author's imagination. Any resemblance to actual people or events is entirely coincidental. For the studios of Books in Motion in Spokane, Washington, I'm Cameron Byerly. Thank you for listening.